Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and pleased to talk prairies today and alternatives to traditional lawns. Maybe a little about invasive plants with Neil Diebel, president of Prairie Nursery of Westfield, Wisconsin, internationally known speaker on prairie restoration. Great to have him back, and certainly if you would like to join in, maybe you've got a question about a prairie, getting one started, or doing something prairie-like perhaps with your lawn, or maybe no-mow with your lawn. Neil has some answers for you, and I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Neil, great to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
You guys are busy now at Prairie Nursery?
Yep, things are cranking up for fall because fall can be a great time to put in plants or seeds.
Okay, so fall is a good time.
Depending on your situation, it can be an excellent time. Absolutely. Yeah. Especially with our no-mow lawn, which is an alternative to more high-maintenance bluegrass lawns.
Yeah, that's a good time in the fall.
Always the best time because September, early October, when you put the grass seed in, it germinates readily, and you have very few weeds that germinate in the fall. So it gets a start without a lot of competition versus a spring seeding when most of your weeds tend to germinate spring and early summer. You get a lot more weed competition with spring lawn seeding. So fall is the best time to plant, assuming your site is ready to go and you've got all the weeds.
Yeah, and that's what I'm wondering. That's what do you need to do to get that site ready to go?
You got
to
make sure all the bad guys are out of there. Okay.
Yeah.
So typically people will prepare their site in advance. If you just have a regular lawn that you want to convert, you can kill that lawn off. You can either remove it with a sod cutter. It's a little late to start smothering it. That usually takes 2 or 3 months to cover it with plastic or cardboard or whatever. Or you can spray it with Roundup just to kill it off and then plant your seed later in the fall.
Well, I tell you what, we've got a caller from Watertown who is with us. I'm not sure who, but we'll find out. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, this is Denise.
Denise, hello, thank you for calling.
Yeah, one of the things that, you know, with this prairie stuff, and we need to really educate communities as much as cities and gated communities to what a prairie benefits and really what it really does it brings to the community. In Watertown years back, one of our big stores, you know, built a new store and they did the prairie look in their green space. And all of a sudden, the city made them mow it all down. And unfortunately, what has happened is, of course, one season, you're not going to have the full effect of your prairie look, but they made them mow this all down. And now what it is just a bunch of undesirable greenery growing there and how horrible and terrible that looks.
Yeah. Well,
can't agree with you more. And it's an educational process. And some people just don't get it. And we have this bias towards nothing more than 6 inches tall in our landscapes unless it's a tree or a shrub. And people really do need to be educated about this. And frankly, I'm surprised that the city of Watertown didn't know this and approved a project like this and then came back and reneged on it and said, oh, you got to cut this down now. And I'll tell you this, there have been a number of cases where people have sued cities regarding their right to have a prairie. And I believe in Wisconsin, every time the person with the prairie has won.
Oh.
So, not that you need to get litigious about it, but if it comes to that, there's plenty of legal precedent to support people having prairies on their properties, whether it's corporation, churches, or individuals.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Denise. Maureen in Eau Claire, we're on to you now. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. Thanks for having this show. It's very timely for me. I have about an acre and a half in Eau Claire area. It's very sandy soil. And I recently, it was a pine plantation in part of the land. I recently had a lot of the red pines cut and turned into a tiny little log cabin in the back, and it opened up a big space. I don't want lawn. And I thought this might be perfect for prairie. There's a lot of, I mean, the space isn't huge. It's about maybe a quarter of an acre in the front and a quarter of an acre in the back. There's a lot of big blue stem growing in our area. But when I was gone for a month after the trees were taken down and I had the slash burned, I have a lot of weeds that I've been slowly taking care of, a lot of stinging nettle and some timothy hay. But basically, it's sandy dirt. Where do I begin?
Okay, that's a great question. First and foremost, your dry, sandy location, and I assume it's pretty much sunny now that the trees are gone, right?
Correct.
Hey, that's a perfect location for a prairie because many of your prairie plants will grow in very dry, sandy soils. You do need to select the appropriate species for that, mm-hmm. but that's a fairly easy process. But the most important thing at this point is for you to eliminate all the existing weeds and other vegetation on the site before you put in your prairie seeds. Because if you don't, a lot of those undesirables or existing vegetation can come back and compete very strongly with your prairie plants. And this is particularly true when you have established perennial plants on the site. You can't just go there and do a dance and throw seeds around and say, okay, grow my prairie. You know, it's not going to quite work like that because the existing plants will have an advantage over those seeds. So you do need to eliminate everything first, whether you use mechanical tillage or Roundup to kill it or pull the plants individually, whatever the situation may be. You do need to make sure everything is gone. And a lot of times you will find in pine plantations, you might have raspberries in there. Do you have something like that by any chance?
A few on the periphery.
Okay, those can be really competitive because they creep by rhizomes underground and can invade.
Yeah.
So you really want to get stuff like that out. Timothy grass is a perennial grass, so you want to get that killed. On a quarter acre, normally what we would do, and there are many ways to do this, but the easiest, most effective way is to kill the plants with Roundup. Again, some people don't want to use any herbicides, in which case you would have to use mechanical tillage to kill them and make sure that you uproot the plants completely so they're completely killed. This doesn't work very well for weeds like quackgrass, which has rhizomes.
Yeah.
Because you can dig that up and dig that up and till it up
just
and till it up.
Just get more and more.
Yeah, it actually can favor it. You have to be very assiduous, and it usually takes a full season from April through September of tilling every 3 to 4 weeks to kill quackgrass and other rhizomatous weeds. So it really depends on what you have on the site. But once everything is gone, then you can plant your prairie seeds. And when you're working with dry, sandy soils, fall is actually usually the best time to put in seed.
Okay.
The reason for that is that this is a dormant seeding, and the seeds will not come up until the next spring.
Mm-hmm.
They'll sit in the soil over the winter, and then in the spring, when the conditions are right, they will germinate. And what's nice about planting in the fall on dry, sandy soils is sandy soils tend to dry out fairly readily. But by planting in the fall, those seeds are pre-positioned to germinate the next spring, and they will come up at the right time when moisture is available, and you actually get better germination and survival with the fall seeding on dry, sandy soils.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
And could you also tell me about the no-mow grass? Could I have areas of that with the prairie or no?
Yes, you can. The no-mow grass is a combination of 6 different varieties of fine fescues. And these are adapted to growing in northern climates. They do very well in Wisconsin. And they do particularly well on dry, sandy, well-drained soils. They are not well adapted to heavy clay soils with less than 4 inches of good loamy topsoil. But in your situation, it should be a good fit. And this also is best planted in the fall, as we talked about earlier, because you will get germination in the fall while there are very few weed seeds coming up. And by next spring, it will fill in. Usually by May or June, it'll be pretty well filled in. The one thing that a lot of people do is they will use the no-mow for trails through their prairie.
Oh.
Or as a perimeter around the prairie.
Very nice.
Okay, and it's very low maintenance. Some people will mow it once a year. It'll send up seed stalks in early June and about 2 feet tall, about knee high, and most people will mow it down to about 4 or 5 inches at that time. And it may be their only annual mowing, or you can mow it every 4, 5, 6 weeks at about 4 to 5 inches to keep it more more crop-type look if you want a more lawn-like look. But it's not going to be a golf course. You cannot mow it to 2 inches because that will harm it. So it's a different look. It's a little wilder, but you don't have to fertilize it. You typically don't have to. You don't have to water it because it's more drought-tolerant because it has deeper roots than bluegrass.
Sure.
It doesn't have the same need for nitrogen and phosphorus that more typical lawns do. So it's a great alternative, especially for planting around lakes and streams where you don't want to fertilize. Wow. So it has a lot of advantages, for especially on sensitive areas or drier soils.
I get that at your nursery?
Yep, you can give us a call at 1-800-476-9453, and you can request a catalog, or you can go to our website at www.prairienursery.com. And prairie is a hard word to spell because it's French. It's P-R-A-I-R-I-E.
Oh, I had E.
I know, it's very easy.
It's very easy. The I's and I's and the A's and where they all go.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you. I'm very excited.
Excellent. Right. And if you have questions, more questions, just give us a call.
All right. Great. Thank you very much for calling, Maureen. Keith in Wisconsin Dells, we're on to you now. Hi, Keith.
Hi. How you doing there? Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
Okay. So my question is now I live probably about 7 miles north of the Dells. I do still have a Dells address to use. I think you're aware. Westfield isn't so far from there. It's really sandy around there. I don't know if the place was a lake at one time or what the deal was. Okay, so where my house sits, I sit in about a 40-acre prairie. It's completely prairie from Highway 13 all the way over to Fawn Lake. And what I want to do with it is there's a road that goes down the center of it, and it separates 20 acres and then 20 acres, or maybe a little less. Maybe it's like 25 and 15.
Okay.
And so half of my house that I sit on is lotted. So I have two lots. It's a corner lot, so it's fairly big. And then it's all mowed off, and then the rest of it is just long grass. It's like probably 3 feet. But what I did was I took some trails and I went through the other long grass all the way around so the kids could walk the trails and stuff. So my question, what I was asking is wildflowers. Now, what can I do along those trails to enhance the wildflowers on the 15-acre side that I live on, as well as planting wildflowers on the actual 2 acres that my house sits on that I mow, that's a pain in the butt of mowing, and I enhance the look with all wildflowers that I know will keep coming back.
Right. Well, Keith, that's going to depend on what's growing there now. And do you have any idea what species of grasses and other plants are in there by any chance?
No, I do not. I can tell you that there is, in the longer grass, there's got to be 20 to 30 different types. And then in just where the house sits, I want to say it's just it's crabgrass.
Okay. Do you have some plants in the long grass that you like right now, or is it pretty much expendable?
Expendable.
Okay. It's hard for me to tell you exactly because I don't know what you've got there. You might have something of value and you might not, but typically in old agriculture fields, we usually don't see a lot of high-quality native plants. So if indeed that is your case, the best way to handle this is to get everything killed off and make sure that you have completely bare soil that you can put your seeds into. Again, if you do not eliminate the existing vegetation, it's going to come back and it's going to haunt you, and it's probably going to outcompete your seeds. In a situation like yours, you have what we call an old field, where it was probably an agricultural field many years ago, and it might have been a cornfield, a hayfield, or whatever. It's grown up to grasses, weeds, etc. So you have two things going on. You have the existing perennial vegetation that now is in control that you need to eliminate, and then you probably have a zillion weed seeds in the soil.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have to deal with both of these. So usually we will spend a couple of years getting the site ready. Now, there are a couple ways to do that. One is to just go out there and spray it with Roundup. Okay, here I go back again with the Roundup thing. Okay, but it's very effective. And you just kill it until everything is dead, usually for a couple of years. This assumes it's not sloping and you have a chance of erosion, because you could have some erosion once the plants are dead. After about a year, the roots of the existing vegetation will start to deteriorate and the soil holding ability will be reduced, and you can't have erosion on hillsides. But it's important to go for 2 years, because that will then deal with the weed seeds in the soil, too, before you put the seed down. And then on your sandy soil, you can go out in the fall of the second year, and you can just scatter the seed across the area on a small area, or on a large area, you can go in with a no-till drill, which you might be able to rent from the DNR, or you can hire a reputable company like Prairie Nursery to do that as well. So, but it's very, very important that you eliminate the existing vegetation.
Now, when can I start to eliminate the existing vegetation? Is this something I need to wait on, or is this something I can do indefinitely immediately?
Well, if we talked a little bit earlier, we might have been able to get you started. Normally, what we would do in your situation is get the area mowed around end of July. And then let everything come back, and then we would do the first application of Roundup in mid-September. And then we would keep going at it for the next couple of years. But however, that's not a big deal. You can start this process next spring if you're going to take 2 years.
Gotcha.
And for people that don't want to use any herbicides, you can use an alternative method called smother crops. And this is the way farmers used to prepare fields before the advent of herbicides. And it's a two-year process. And in the spring, usually around late May, after the danger of frost has passed, you plow the field up, get it level, and plant a crop of buckwheat, which is kind of hard to find. Okay, but you put about 1.5 bushels of buckwheat per acre, and buckwheat is this big leaves that spread across the plant and smother the weeds below. And this was used to control weeds like quackgrass 100 years ago. When the buckwheat is in full flower, which is usually, if you plant it in early June, usually around mid-August, you mow it down. Do not let it go to seed, or you will have buckwheat for life.
Okay.
And then you mow that down, and you use this as what we call a green manure. It actually improves the soil by adding organic matter, because you're going to plow it under. Then you wait a few weeks until about mid-September, and then you put in winter wheat. Now, the winter wheat will hold the soil over the winter, and then in the spring, it will start to head out. When it starts to head out, usually in late May, early June, you mow it down, plow it under, and plant a second crop of buckwheat. Run that buckwheat that summer, let it grow, until August, plow it under, and then you can plant your prairie in the fall. This works great on dry sandy soils. It works on clay soils. It's great because it helps to improve poor soils by adding organic matter as you kill the weeds, and you don't have to use any chemicals.
Yeah, there you go.
Excellent. Thank you.
You bet. Good luck.
Thanks, Keith. Appreciate your call. Neil Debo, president of Prairie Nursery, our guest here on Garden Talk. Jim Packard, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Neil Debo of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. And we turn to another Larry in Elkhorn. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I'm calling about, I live in Elkhorn, but I have a place up in Land O'Lakes, Wisconsin. My wife and I really like lupines, and we've seen them in the area. Last weekend, we got some seeds, lupine seeds up there. And the lady told us just to scratch them into the soil a little bit, that this is a good time to get them growing. But I'm wondering, is there something we should plant with them? We want to plant them out in our front yard in a bed, and maybe that's not the right thing to do. But when they're not blooming, we don't want to just have a bed of brown dead flowers there. So I was wondering if there's something that we can plant in conjunction with them. Mm-hmm. And then have it in a bed so I can mow the rest of the yard and still have it look nice.
You bet. Yes, you can plant with the lupines other flowers that might bloom later in the season, because the lupine is a spring bloomer, usually blooms in June, produces seed in July, and then tends to go dormant and kind of turns black. Most people don't consider black a nice garden color, but that's a matter of opinion, of course. And it kind of disappears. So you could plant later blooming plants that will thrive in sandy soils, and there are many of them. And you can also add some of your native prairie grasses. Like, I assume your area is sandy, is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's very sandy.
Okay, and that's a perfect place for the native lupine. It only grows in sand. And I can't tell you how many people have tried to grow lupine in loam or even sandy loam or, God forbid, clay, and it just doesn't go. Uh-huh. And so you have the perfect site for lupine. You could add some of the native prairie grasses like prairie drop seed or a little blue stem, but don't put in too much because they will compete with the lupine, and if you put too much grass in, it can squeeze it out. Lupine likes open, sandy soil for its best development, but if you don't put other plants around it, you're going to have a lot of weeds that come up next to it.
So,
and the nice thing about some of the prairie grasses, like the little blue stem and prairie drop seed, is that they grow low, they grow in dry sand, and they are more active later in the season after the lupine is done, so they kind of cover up the dead lupine stems and seed pods.
There you go.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
You bet. Good luck.
Good luck. Thanks for calling, Larry. Bob in Menasha, on to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a question for you. Is there anything that has recently come down on information on getting rid of reed canary grass other than Roundup or shade trees?
Oh, boy. Reed canary grass, the bane of our existence. That is a tough one. There are a lot of people doing a lot of research on this, and I do not claim to be an expert on reed canary grass, but there are a lot of people working on ways to eliminate it. But the problem with reed canary grass is that it creeps by rhizomes, it spreads by seeds, it's a really tough customer, and even after you kill it off, there's usually weed seeds still in the soil bank that will germinate and reinfest the area.
I understand there's like, for every seed pod, there's like a million seeds or something.
It makes a lot of seeds.
Third.
Yeah. Do you have desirable plants in this area, or are you just going to eliminate the reed canary grass and plants?
Well, but basically, I have the area. I own some land on the Manitowoc River in Manitowoc County. It's a bottomland. Originally, I think it was a bottomland hardwood that was due to disease from chestnut blight and elm. Dutch elm, it's killed off the trees, so when the trees went, the shade or the sun came in and the reed canary grass came along with it.
Right.
And there's some areas I'm trying to reforest, and moderate success, just because of the canary grass. I spot sprayed, that seemed to be working around the trees I planted.
Yeah.
But, it's a never-ending battle.
But your ultimate goal is to restore a woodland there, is that correct?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do, yes.
Okay, well, I think the trees are going to be your best weapon, because once they start to produce shade, I know it's going to take a while, but if you can continue to control the weeds around the bases of those trees, like 3 or 4 feet in diameter, around the individual trees. As they mature, they will start to cast shade, and the reed canary grass is relatively shade intolerant. If you want to get rid of it in general, you know, you're going to have to either mow the area fairly regularly or spray it with Roundup or till it up or something like that. But none of these are great solutions because you have to replace the reed canary grass with something else.
Right.
And depending
on... Well, I've played the mowing game, and it just seemed they grew well. They grew better, and I had a very nice reed canary grass lawn.
Yes, you
are. I mean, it's just... And it floods every year. I mean, the whole area is a flood basin. So,
sure.
And some of the area, I do harvest canary grass and sell it to local farmers.
Sure.
But the peripheral area, yeah, I'm trying to go and reforest. And it's, you know, like I said, moderate success. So other than Roundup and shade, nothing new has come down the pipe on that.
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, there are some techniques you can use to control it. And for people that have sedge meadows that have been invaded by reed canary grass, there are techniques that you can use to really knock the reed canary grass back and favor the native sedges and other flowers. But it's a very difficult management method. And what you do is you burn that area in mid-June when the reed canary grass is in flower. That is when it is most susceptible to damage, and the sedges and native flowers come back much better than the reed canary grass. However, if you have ever burned a marshy grassland in June, you know it is a messy, stinky fire because you're burning all that green material. It's a very difficult situation.
Yeah, I've had some control. I've done some controlled burns.
Yeah, probably
get
earlier.
Rid of the thatch, and then you can hit it with Roundup, and that's reasonably successful doing it that way.
Yes. But then you got to put something else in there to keep the reed canary from coming back.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's where you get into some issues of what's going to be really competitive with it. And in a wetland situation, there are some species you can use, but they tend to be more expensive, like sedges and other native grasses. The wetland species tend to be a little more expensive on large areas. It's kind of a quandary, and people are working on this. But reed canary grass is one of those species that is so invasive and so aggressive, it's really hard to control. I think you're planting the trees and shading it out is probably going to be your best and most cost-effective option.
Yeah, that's my thought. It'd be nice if there were a bug or something like to control purple loosestrife, but they haven't made one yet.
No, and they're working on them. I was out west just a couple weeks ago, and they have a terrible problem with tamarisk invading their wetlands in their riparian wetlands. And I'll tell you what, there was a lot of dead tamarisk that the bugs are killing. So who knows? Oh. Maybe reed canary grass is on the horizon for the bug people.
Thanks, Bob. Thank you for calling. We will turn to John in Walworth next. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting program, as usual. My concern is with a couple of beauties, ground morning glory or bindweed, and crown vetch in a small established backyard prairie. I've done Roundup, and it works fine for a few weeks and kills the top, but it always comes back, both the crown vetch and bindweed. Is there any specific herbicide that a licensed applicator could use to come in and solve my problem?
Yes, there are. You have two of the most difficult weeds to control because they are rhizomatous. They have, and in the case of the bindweed, it has tubers under the ground, and Roundup is not effective. It just kills the leaves back, as you pointed out.
Right.
It does not systemically kill the roots. There are other herbicides that can be used for this, but they're broadleaf herbicides that typically are considered a little more biologically active than Roundup. But you can use a combination of Roundup and broadleaf weed killers, and that typically will take them out. It might require two or three successive sprayings a couple of months apart after they resprout between sprayings, but a combination of Roundup and a combination broadleaf, like a Trimec or something like that, typically will take these out, but it usually takes two or three applications. And, of course, you have to be extremely careful not to spray any other plants nearby because it will kill them also.
And that's something that the homeowner can use in terms of the herbicide Trimec.
Yeah, I'd have to check on that, whether you need a license for that. I have a license, so it's not a big deal, but... you would have to check on that. But it's absolutely amazing what you can get at Fleet Farm and Farm and Fleet that the homeowner can use. You know, you look at the label and it's like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
So you want to be extremely careful with these because these are powerful herbicides. And but I'm sure you will find something there because they have quite an array of broadleafs. And read the label. Always, always, always
sure.
read the label.
Yeah.
Educate yourself. Make sure it's the right herbicide for the weeds you're trying to kill and be very, very careful.
All right. Thank you so much.
You bet. Good luck.
And Richard in Waukesha, we're turning to you now. Hi, Richard.
Hello. I got two questions. One is about crabgrass, whether this is a bad summer for it or not, and then ultimately how to take care of it.
Okay, let's make sure that we're talking about the annual crabgrass digitaria, Sanguinalis. It creeps along the ground and has these little kind of bird feet of seed heads on them, is that correct?
Right, exactly.
Okay, good, because a lot of people confuse quackgrass with crabgrass, so I just want to make sure we have the right thing. Yeah, crabgrass is an annual grass. It's a warm season annual. It typically germinates in May, sometimes June, depending on the year. And this year, I haven't seen a lot of it, but it depends. You know, that's just my situation. Because we've had a lot of warm weather, it would certainly favor the growth of warm season annual grasses in open soil situations. And the places where crabgrass really does well is in open soil because as an annual, it needs open ground in order to germinate. So if you have, and where you typically see it is in lawns that are really dry, sandy lawns that are not fully established or sometimes really bad clay where yeah. you have open areas and the grass is not established because of problems with soil, the soil conditions. So the best way to prevent crabgrass is to make sure you have the right conditions. And I assume, is this in a lawn situation or in a prairie, or what kind of situation?
Yeah, it's in a lawn. We have about an acre, and in the past we've had spots in the yard, and I put a preventer on at the beginning of the season,
mm-hmm.
and I've never had such a problem with it. It's just made the lawn look terrible.
Really? Because yeah. typically if you put it depends on the crabgrass preventer, there are various types. There are the pre-emergent herbicides, and there's corn gluten, which is an organic choice for use. But either one of these typically works well. However, what might have happened in your case is that we've had so much rain this year.
Yeah.
Is it probably washed the herbicide or the corn gluten out of the system and freed right. up the conditions? Once it's out of the, once it's washed through the soil, it doesn't have the retentive period, because normally that stuff stays around for a couple of months, which is the period of germination for crabgrass. What probably happened is because of the rain, it was washed out, and without reapplying another few weeks later, the crabgrass probably got started. And I'm assuming it came in a little bit later than normal. Is that correct?
Probably. Yeah, it did.
Yeah, okay. Almost certainly, the whatever you put down washed out of the system, and it gave the crabgrass seeds that were lying dormant in the soil the opportunity to germinate and grow. And I'm almost certain that's it. The most important thing for you to do at this point is to create the proper conditions for your lawn to be healthy, because a healthy lawn will fill in and prevent crabgrass naturally by just the virtue of a dense root system. So you might want to check what's going on with your soil. It might be a pH issue, might be a soil soil conditions. It might be compacted.
Yeah.
Is it a dry sandy soil or a clay soil? What
it's
do you have?
A clay.
Okay, you probably have some issues with your breathability of your soil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you might have to go in there and deal with some compaction or something like that and get the soil worked up. You might have to add some organic matter to the surface, some good topsoil, in order to create a proper growing environment for a lawn. Okay, and that will help prevent the crabgrass. And then, once you get your lawn established, you won't have to put any chemicals on it.
Fantastic.
Okay, good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Joe emailed in to say, in relation to an earlier caller who was going to plant some purple lupine, wanted to remind that purple lupine is an invasive species in northern Wisconsin, and people are putting in a great effort to rid the lakeshore of its presence. So the caller of Land O'Lakes needs to be aware of what he is planting.
Good point. There are two types of lupine, and I assume that he was talking about the native lupine. There is the native lupine, Lupinus perennis, which is a native perennial, and then there is the non-native Lupinus polyphyllus, which is an introduced species, typically biennial, that grows along Lake Superior, Lake Michigan, mostly on Lake Superior. And it can be quite invasive. It's a very beautiful plant. Any of you have read Miss Rumpheus, this beautiful little book about this little girl in this lady in Maine, and she grew lupines, and it's all very nice, but it can be a rather invasive plant. So, yeah, you want to be very selective about which lupines you plant.
Lori and Krivitz, on to you now. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Well, I'm glad you said that about lupine, because I just planted, like, four purple plants and one red. So
that helps, because that was one of my questions was, are what are typically native perennials sometimes invasive? And I guess they are. I'm trying to stay with strictly natives. I was wondering, with the black snake root, there's Cimicifuga, and then there's another one I just saw in the greenhouse this morning. It's A-C-L-E. Oh, no, that's not the one. A-C-T-A-E-A.
Ectea. Mm-hmm.
Are either of those native?
Well, you have two native Ecteas, and they keep changing the Latin name, so good luck on this. Ectea rubra, which is native to our mesic woodlands, and Ectea alba, depends which name you up, or Pachypoda. This is the white doll's eyes. Okay, these two are native Ecteas, and they keep changing these names around. They're in the same family, and so you'll have, same as if you get the Ecteas all getting all mixed together. But it's unfortunate when the common names become more reliable than the Latin names, but that's kind of where we are. So depending on what names they are using, the baneberry, which is the Ectea rubra, and the white doll's eyes, the Ectea pachypoda, are both native. Cimicifuga racemosa is also native farther south and east. It's more of an Appalachian species. I don't know if there are actually any confirmed locations in Wisconsin historically where it was native to. It grows fine here typically if you're not too far north or in zone 3, but I believe that technically it is not native. I'm almost positive it's not native to Oconal County if that's an issue for you. But Ectea rubra and Ectea pachypoda would be considered natives to northeastern Wisconsin.
There you go.
Oh, I have one more question.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Larry.
I saw some grass in a neighboring field, and it's about a foot high. This is all sand, about a foot high, and it was pink, and now it's turned to like golden.
Mm-hmm.
Or could I take that somewhere and maybe have somebody like in Green Bay or Horticultural Center or something that would know if it was native, because it was really pretty grass.
Okay. Yeah, it's really pink, and it kind of spreads. It has a spreading, it has a spreading growth form, right? Kind of low.
Yeah, and it looks almost like smoke.
Yeah, and and it's on really dry sand.
Yeah.
Okay, that's called purple lovegrass. Almost for sure, I'll give you 95% confidence interval on this. The purple lovegrass, Aragrostis spectabilis. Spectabilis, it creates quite a spectacle. You can go out there and collect the seed and take it home and throw it in your sand, and it'll probably grow.
Is that native?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You
great.
Bet. Yep. It's a beautiful, beautiful grass. It's an underutilized grass. I think one of the reasons people don't use it is because it is kind of sort of weedy, depending on what your definition of weed is. It grows in open, sandy fields. And in the fall, the seed will blow around. The stems will break off and blow around, and it'll crawl up your pants leg or something like that. You know, it's like big deal. So, but it's a gorgeous, gorgeous grass, and it's a fantastic grass for really super dry, sandy soil, and it creates that wonderful, ethereal, pink, smoky look right about this time of year.
Great. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and the seed should be very close to ripe. Monitor it, and you can just collect the stems and go put it on the ground where you want it to grow. If it's open sand, and in a couple of years, you should probably see some purple lovegrass on your property.
Great. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for calling in. Kim in Randall, Wisconsin. We're on to you now. Hi, Kim.
Hi. I have a business where I rent goats for weed control. And they will eat reed canary grass. They won't damage the root system, though. However, I wondered if you put geese on it, because geese tear everything up. Geese, once they've grazed something, then they start ripping the roots out of the ground. And I have some geese, but I haven't put them on reed canary grass anywhere.
Well, I think someone needs to do this test. And I admire what you're doing, because I have a client out in Pennsylvania, and they were completely... You think we have invasive plants here. Go to southeastern Pennsylvania. I mean, the whole place was completely taken over, and we put goats on it, and they took everything out. Of course, we had to fence all the trees.
Yeah.
Yes, you do. You have to wrap. Well, most trees, big trees, they won't touch, but they do like to peel maple and apple.
I tell you, they like to peel. We had some big trees in there, and we fenced everything because they were on the...
Well, you probably have to move them before they get to that stage. I just worked them up near Waterford on a 150-acre property. And mostly I'm taking out buckthorn. And I've got a lot of big oaks and stuff, but the whole understory is buckthorn, honeysuckle, and multiflora rose, and some other junk. And they pretty much leave the native stuff alone. They will eat the oak leaves off the smaller trees. And usually, though, they leave that for last. They prefer the buckthorn.
Yep, and you know, they like poison ivy, too.
Oh, they do. I've got one that'll stand up on the tree and pull the vines down.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it doesn't bother them at all, and they love it.
Yep.
They take it down to the ground. It does come back. I keep track of the time of year when they graze it, and
mm-hmm.
then I try to get back and see how long it takes to leaf out. In fact, I'm doing some studies. I got a grant, and I've got little study pens. And I started putting goats in there, and like in a 30 by 60 pen that's all buckthorn, goats will take it down in a couple days, depending on the biomass.
Mm-hmm.
And then after about 4 weeks, the leaves might be about an inch long.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put the four goats back in there, and they'll take it down in 2 to 4 hours.
Wow. And they'll strip the bark right off of it, right?
If you leave them in there with buckthorn, they will strip the bark.
Yep.
They like to peel buckthorn.
Yep.
I've got what I call the barkless buckthorn forest. It's in my barnyard. I've peeled all the bark. In winter, when they're eating rich alfalfa, they like the bark to balance it, I guess.
Sure, sure.
And they peel all the bark off of all the buckthorn. But they left the... ash leaf maple. What's the other name for it?
Oh, the xanthoxylum. The prickly ash?
No, they love prickly ash. Is that native?
Yes.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, and it's not all bad. You know, it's a host for one of our butterflies, for one of the swallowtail butterflies.
Is it really?
Yes.
I wonder if I'm identifying it correctly. It's like razor wire.
Does it have, it has thorns all over it, right?
Yeah, and does it get tree size about?
It gets about 2 inches in diameter.
Uh-huh.
6 to 8, maybe 10 feet tall.
Uh-huh.
Grows
and
in
it's
clumps.
It's kind of a white bark,
yep.
And it's got short thorns.
Yep, and it creeps by rhizomes to form patches.
Yep.
Xanthoxylum americanum, almost for sure, prickly ash.
Okay, that's one of their new favorites. That was
a
display.
I bet that's luscious to them. That's, yeah, they'll eat the whole thing down to the ground, I bet.
Yeah, if it's, well, most of them were taller.
Oh, I see, uh-huh.
But they'd had a tree place come through in, actually it was March of this year, which really surprised me, because the first area I put them in, the buckthorn and everything was about 7 feet high, and it was so solid. It was the regrowth with, you know, the million stems.
Sure, right.
That the goats couldn't get in. I opened the gate. I put up electric net fencing, and then I opened the gate, and we let 11 yearling leathers in there, and they couldn't get in. They had to stand in the open gate and eat their way in. And I asked her when she cut it, and she said, "Wow, March." And I said, "What, 2009? She says, "No, like 3 months ago."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, stuff is gross.
And it was that, so it was between 4 and 7 feet tall,
yep.
And just absolutely impenetrable.
Yep,
and they mowed it down.
Oh, yeah, they took that down. I had 11 in there, and they took that down. It took them about 12 days. And there was also blackberries and fox grape and everything, and I know some of that's native, but it gets out of control.
Yeah, it can kill your trees. Yep.
Yeah.
Just because a plant is native.
Fox grape can pull a tree over.
Yeah, there's a few native plants out there that most people might not really care to have, so like poison ivy.
So what's the name of your business,
Kim?
Once you cut
it down, the goats can keep it down.
What's the name of your business?
The Green Goats. It's thegreengoats.com.
Wow.
All right.
Excellent.
Well, it sounds like a good way to get rid of buckthorn, that's for sure. GreenGoats.com. Don't be surprised, Kim, if you don't get some phone calls. Let's go to Kitty in Winter, Wisconsin. In fact, Kitty, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Well, I'd like to know if your guest has a financial interest in Monsanto, because every other sentence he recommends Roundup. I'm concerned that we don't know the long-term effects of these kinds of herbicides. I live on a river, and I also live in a city. I live in Boston. And the groundwater there, the runoff just from the lawns, goes into the storm sewers, goes into the treatment plants. There must be some other recommendation other than killing everything with this horrible herbicide. I'm just appalled that you seem to know so much about nature and so much about the plant world, and I can't believe that you're recommending that we poison everything that we just don't like. There are other ways to get rid of things.
Well, and you do talk about other ways to get rid of things, but go ahead and address this Roundup issue.
Sure, and it's a very contentious issue. And I used to be completely organic. I used no herbicides whatsoever. I used soil tillage, which has its own drawbacks. In fact, on hillsides, you have terrible problems with erosion, so you can't use tillage there. If you do an environmental impact statement of how much fuel you use, going out there every 3 weeks, you're using hydrocarbons to till the ground up. That's another option, but the amount of energy is huge. And I find that you use some herbicides in order to achieve a long-term goal. Once you have completed using them and have established your vegetation, you should not have to go back and use them again. I completely understand the caller's concern about this. There's a lot of contentious issues regarding Roundup. Some people say that it has some severe ecological effects, and some people say it does not, you know, but I do not have any interest in Monsanto, and I make sure that I always provide people with a variety of different options, whether it's tillage or smother crops or whatever. But it is one option for people to use, and I think it's fair for people to consider that as an option. And supposedly, and I'm not a herbicide researcher, supposedly after the herbicide hits the ground, it breaks down and is no longer toxic, at least to plants. However, there is some contention about what those breakdown products do, and that's still an unknown. It really is. But if you look at the herbicides that are used routinely on lawns, okay, the Roundup pales in comparison to the millions of tons of herbicides used on lawns, on our wheat crop to control weeds. It's absolutely unbelievable. And this is going on your food. And people may not know this, but there is an incredible amount of broadleaf herbicides, which are much more biologically active and potentially more dangerous, that are used routinely on lawns, food crops, etc. So I completely understand what the caller is saying. And for people that do not want to use these chemicals, there are many, many options available, and that's why we make sure to mention those also.
Neil Deball, president of the Prairie Nursery, Westfield, Wisconsin, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with my guest Neil Deball of Prairie Nursery. And we'll take some more calls. Benji in Appleton, I think, up next. Hi, Benji. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just curious about the low mole grass seed that you talked about. Understanding that it's not going to have the manicured appearance that a bluegrass would it still be appropriate for my urban lot in Appleton?
Properly managed, yes. And it's, we call it our no-mo lawn. Actually, low-mo is a good terminology because in your situation, if you're going to use it in an urban situation, you are going to want to mow it probably every month or so. And what this lawn does is it's, again, a combination of six different fine fescue varieties, and they will grow longer than your bluegrass, and you need to mow it higher. You should never mow fine fescues closer than 3.5 inches above the ground. So it's going to be a taller lawn. If you mow it below 3.5, you can do long-term damage to the plants. So if you want a 2-inch tall bluegrass lawn, this is not the product for you. But for people that don't want to put on herbicides or especially fertilizers, this is a great choice because it doesn't require high nitrogen and phosphorus levels. So if you start this as a lawn, you want to make sure and begin mowing it at that level. Don't let it get long because it will grow 6 inches long. If you let it grow to its full length, you do not want to come in there and scalp it down to 3.5 inches. It will look terrible. So you want to start mowing it in the spring. Late spring probably would be your first mowing at 3.5 to 4 inches, and then probably once a month or so. And we have many clients that have done this in that situation. So instead of mowing your lawn every 10 days, you mow it every 30 days, which for me, that's like, wow, yeah, that's a major improvement in my life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
Okay, now one thing you want to be careful, you're in Appleton. Do you have clay soil?
Yes.
Okay, do you have at least 4 inches of good loamy topsoil over that clay?
We might get to 4.
Okay, because if you don't, if you have dry weather, hot, dry weather, the fescues may struggle in that situation because they will not have sufficiently deep roots. They don't really penetrate down into that clay. Okay, this is one of the disadvantages of this particular formulation of lawn, is that it's not great on raw clay. It does need 4 inches of good, loose topsoil over that clay in order to perform well during drought. During the rest of the year, if it's nice and moist and everything, no problem. But if you get into a drought situation, that's where you're running into some trouble.
Okay, well, good. Thank you.
You bet. Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. So then you may have to water.
Yes, then you can water. Of course, the whole idea with this is you don't want to put any chemicals on it. You don't want to put any fertilizers on it. You don't want to water. It's supposed to be really, really low maintenance. But and we always make sure to be conservative in our claims as far as where it's going to do well. So we always want to warn people that where it's really going to work best for them so they will get the desired result.
Let's turn to Luba in Madison. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. I have a crabgrass problem, and I have quite a bit of it in my front lawn. My lawn has been ignored for 2 years. I've had a cat, so I've never used any herbicides. And my problem is I've pulled some of the crabgrass out, and I have clay soil, and I don't notice that there's no grass growing underneath it because I have this carpet.
A carpet of crabgrass or a carpet?
Yes.
Okay.
Is it going to come back or?
Oh, yes. Yes, if you have open soil, open clay soil, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where crabgrass is going to thrive. And again, its life cycle as a warm season annual grass is that it germinates when the soil warms up in May and June and then grows during the year, makes seeds, and dies. But all those seeds are going to then lead to new plants the following year. So how do you deal with this? Really, the thing to do is to renovate your lawn so that you have the right growing conditions for your selected lawn grass. So that's the best way to do this, because that keeps you from then having to fight the crabgrass with chemicals or some other kind of preventer. But again, if you have an established lawn with just small problems, you don't have to use chemicals. You can use corn gluten. And corn gluten has been shown to be as effective as chemical herbicides in preventing the germination of crabgrass and other weeds when applied at the right time in spring. But I think first and foremost, you have to address the growing conditions in your soil. And I bet you have very compacted clay. Is that possible?
Probably, yes.
And probably has a low organic matter content in the surface. Is that also possible?
Right, because I just haven't done any. I've had other obligations, and I've just had to ignore the lawn other than cutting it. And I always pull things by hand, and I can usually handle things, and I've taken care of the dandelion situation.
Mm-hmm.
When I dug up the crabgrass in certain areas, there was just soil there and no grass at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, well, I haven't watered it. I just did it yesterday. And I wondered if watering that grass would come back, or is it gone?
If there's nothing there, it's gone.
It's gone.
Probably, yeah, because we have not had the kind of drought conditions that would lead to grass going dormant. The grass lawns have stayed green this year, so whatever you see is probably what you've got. So to renovate that lawn, you're going to first and foremost probably want to do a soil test.
Yes.
You can send that into the Soil and Plant Analysis Lab here in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, I do not have their number handy, but
I think I've got it somewhere
on
record.
And you can call them, and they will tell you exactly how to take your sample. And things you're going to want to check are things like pH,
mm-hmm.
calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, potassium, your basic soil nutrients. But I suspect probably your main problem is that you probably have a low organic matter content, and your clay is compacted so that basically it doesn't breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And if your soil doesn't breathe, most plants cannot grow in it. Now, crabgrass is a surface-rooted annual. It doesn't need a lot of good soil to grow, and it takes advantage of that condition. So you're probably going to have to till this area up and add some organic matter in order to open up that clay and get some breathability, because the breathability allows air down to the roots, and roots need air. They breathe also, as well as infiltration of moisture so the plants can uptake water for their growth. So it's going to be a bit of a process to renovate this.
Yes, it is.
But that's the thing to do, and make sure that you check your soil first to make sure that you don't have to amend it in any way to make the best conditions for growing your lawn.
Oh, thank you.
You bet. Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Tom in Madison, your turn. Hi, Tom. Tom, are you there? Well, maybe we lost Tom. Must have lost Tom. Let's go to Greg in Green Bay. Greg, hello to you.
Hey, guys. I had a weed in my lawn last year. I'm not sure what it was. It looked like a Bart Simpson's head, the top of his head. That's how I describe it.
Okay.
So it was a patch of grass, thick grass that was round. It could be anywhere from, you know, a frisbee size to, boy, you know, 6x6 patch. But the grass looked, like I said, like Bart Simpson's head, real tight to the lawn. And I'm just curious what that is, A. And then B is what I did is I used about three or four Roundup treatments, which, you know, yeah, maybe I shouldn't have, but I didn't know what else to do with it. And it seems to have gone pretty well. But now when I replanted, all the places where it was are kind of brown compared to the rest of the lawn, which I'm guessing is due to just the different type of grass that's growing, and I'm hoping. But what kind of weed do you think that is?
Boy, that's kind of hard to say. Bart Simpson's head on top of a grass, is that it?
Yeah, if you just chopped it off, you know, at the top. It's just like crowned out and real pretty thick
Looks like grass. That's I can do a lot of identification over the phone, but this is a tough one. And the reason everything is brown is because you sprayed it with Roundup, and you probably killed everything that was there, I'm guessing, because, you know, Roundup is pretty indiscriminate. It kills almost everything, grasses, weeds, et cetera. So anywhere it hits is going to kill the vegetation. But really, I'm sorry, I really have a hard time figuring out what you've got as far as, because there are many, 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 many different
many
grassy
different
weeds.
Kinds.
Although Bart Simpson's head should be pretty distinctive, but I'm not really sure what you got there. So
sorry, we can't help you, Greg.
Thanks.
All right, thanks for calling. And we've got about 30 seconds here. Bonnie was wondering if Wisconsin plants natives along our roadsides, and how can citizens help this effort?
Well, in the 80s, Wisconsin DOT did quite a bit of planting, 80s and 90s, of natives, but they seem to have scaled back their program, and you'd have to contact them on the specifics. But I think that there were some areas where they didn't have a lot of success, and I think a lot of that was due to the fact there wasn't a lot of post-planting management. And that's one of the things about prairies. You don't just throw the seed in the ground and walk away.
Yeah,
it's not a no-maintenance landscape. It is a low-maintenance landscape, and you can save a ton of time and money compared to a lawn, but you got to do a little maintenance, and it has to be timely, and it has to be done correctly. And you can't just put seed down and walk away. So make sure that you follow directions, and we have all that information on our website.
Neil Diebold, president of Prairie Nursery. His website, by the way, is prairienursery.com. Here on Garden Talk, I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Neil Diebold, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, nationally known speaker on prairie restoration. Great to have him with us. And Neil, you've got an event coming up tomorrow, do you not?
Yes, we have our fall nursery tour tomorrow, August 21st, Saturday, at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. we have tours.
Okay.
And then we have our greenhouse there where people can buy plants, and we do have some seeds available as well. But people come to see our display gardens. We have some very nice display gardens. And we will also have a photography session at 11:30 by Randy Roden, who is a graphic artist and photographer. So he'll have a little tutorial there for people that want to learn more about photography of wildflowers. So tours at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. and photography at 11:30.
And Westfield, Wisconsin, of course, I suppose if you go to the website, you've got...
Yes, if you go to our website at prairienursery.com and look at Contact Us over on the right-hand side of the bar at the top, you'll see map to our retail store.
Okay.
And display gardens. So,
and just go there. And what are the times again?
10 a.m. and 1 p.m. The tours are about an hour. And then you can pick up some plants, seeds, or whatever. And if you come at 11:30, also you can go through Randy's photography session.
Perfect. Let's go to Tom in Madison. Tom, hello to you. Thank you for calling.
Hello, and thank you.
What can we do for you?
Two things. One, I have to concur with the man concerned about the indiscriminate use of plant killers like Roundup.
Yes.
To say that there's worse doesn't make it better. The focal use of it can be useful, but I think they're discovering more and more health problems associated with it. And it seems so against what's being tried to be done.
And did you have a question?
No, I have another statement about the woman who called nettle weed. I consider it a valid and important native plant. There are several species of butterflies that use it as a feed. The caterpillars use it for feeding. It's also nutritious and has health benefits for several male problems.
Comment, Neil?
Are you talking about the xanthoxylum, the prickly ash?
No, the I thought she talked about prickly, stinging nettle.
Oh, stinging nettle. Oh, yeah. Stinging nettle, a number of butterflies will use that. And it makes a great soup.
So, oh, it does?
Oh, yeah. Nettle soup is great. Wonderful. You have to cook it or it'll be really stingy.
Yeah.
But no, I don't know anything about its medicinal properties, but it makes a wonderful soup. And again, there's a lot of contentious discussion about Roundup. There's a lot of research being done on this. We view it as a necessary evil in order to create to accomplish a greater good with restoration, because it is just the best way to get rid of weeds in many situations. But there are alternatives in almost every situation, so you do not have to use it, and it is only one choice out there. So people do not have to use that type of method if they are uncomfortable with that. But I think the things that are really, really concerning are the heavy-duty chemicals that are used, again, in lawn care and food production. These are the things we really should be concerned with. And, yeah, it would be great if we didn't have to use any chemicals. It would be great if we didn't have to use gasoline. It would be great if we didn't have to use any of that kind of stuff. But there are some trade-offs we make, and this may be one of them for some people.
Let's turn to Jude in Long Lake next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. I have fairly successfully planted his Nomo fescue on a hillside up here.
Okay.
And the problem I'm having is I've got some creeping Charlie that got into it, and I'm not sure what to do with that. And I will get off the air and listen.
Oh, boy, creeping Charlie. Creeping Charlie is a tough customer. And it would be great if you're still on the air, because I was going to ask you if it's in the shade or in the sun.
Full sun.
Okay. Yep. Here, I'll tell you what. At my house, I have lots of Nomo. And do you mow this occasionally? I assume you do, correct?
Well, no, I haven't. I kind of weed whack it now and then.
Okay, but it does get some kind of mowing, right? Is it around the house in an area where you want to keep it lower?
Or is it's an area I just don't want to cut at all. It's in the woods, and
okay.
I just want to let it be.
Okay, let me give you a little insight on this. At my house, I mow my Nomo about a couple times a year around the house at a height of about 4 inches.
Okay.
Outside of that, I just let it grow. It gets pretty long. And it makes a nice flowing carpet, okay? Mm-hmm. But it's super low maintenance. I have almost no weeds in it. The areas that I mow are the only areas where I have dandelions and creeping Charlie. The unmowed areas have almost no weeds. Now, why is that? Because the unmowed areas, the leaves of the grass grow long, and they smother out these basal-leaved species like creeping Charlie and dandelions, which require mowing for their existence because their leaves are close to the ground. So every time you mow it, you open them up to sun, so they thrive. By not mowing, the Nomo typically will squeeze them out. However, the drawback here is if you want a shorter lawn, then you are going to create the conditions that favor dandelions, creeping Charlie, and other more low-growing basal-leaved plants. So if you want to get rid of the creeping Charlie, don't mow.
Don't mow. David and Hayward, on to you. Hi, David.
Hello. Am I coming through?
Yes.
All right. I'm a beekeeper in Hayward by the airport. So I'm working for Froggy's Honey Farm. And my question all revolves around Sweet Joe Pie weed, which I understand is a native flowering prairie flower. So I haven't been able to get it to come up. I've spent a couple of $100. You might know the seeds are expensive.
Right.
So whatever advice you can give me, I am restoring a prairie in around the Sawyer County Airport. So okay. I'll take whatever advice you can give me off the air.
Okay. Sweet Joe Pieweed, Eupatorium purpureum, is actually a woodland plant, not a prairie plant. Most of your Joe Pieweeds, most of the members of the genus Eupatorium, are full sun to half a day of full sun plants. The Sweet Joe Pieweed is one of a couple species of Eupatorium that are a woodland plant. So it might be that your growing conditions may not be right for it if you're planting it in a full sun situation.
Planting it around an airport, so it's got to be open.
Right. It's probably not going to grow well. Your other Eupatoriums that do well in the sun, and the most common one in Wisconsin, is Eupatorium maculatum, which is just straight Joe Pieweed, sometimes called spotted Joe Pieweed. Likes full sun to a little bit of shade, but it requires a moist soil, a moist organic soil. So if it's like an upland situation or a drier situation, it's probably not going to thrive for you. So if you want to grow Sweet Joe Pieweed, plant it in a nice medium or mesic soil, a nice loamy soil in a shaded woodland where it doesn't have too much competition from other plants, and you'll probably get much better results.
Let's turn to Scott in Aurora, Illinois next. Hi, Scott.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
I have to revisit your bindweed comments. I have a bindweed nightmare happening in the house, and it's gone on for several years. I'm hesitant to use, the Roundup and those products. I have in the past, but I grow my own hops for beer and, have a vegetable garden and that kind of thing. Any long-term way to get rid of this stuff? It just seems to keep coming back even after using Roundup.
Yes. As we talked about earlier, Roundup does not kill bindweed. There are a number of species that Roundup doesn't kill. Bindweed and crown vetch and Canada thistle. It's not very effective on those. So you have a couple of options here. If you want to kill plants like this, you can smother them. Okay. Some people use black plastic, but hey, where did black plastic came from? It came from oil. Okay.
Right.
And where do you, can you recycle that black plastic after it sat on your ground for a couple of years? Probably not. So it's not a very easily recyclable item. The other choice is to put down big hunks of cardboard and cover that with organic matter, leaf clippings, etc., for 2 to 3 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, I'm talking long term. 1 year won't do it. Because those the problem with the bindweed is they have these little, if you've ever dug them up, you'll see it has these little nodules underground in the roots. Those have a very long life. It's just like a big storage unit for carbohydrates that is the plant energy. So you have to smother that for an extended period of time. Your other choice is to go in there with a rototiller and till it up every 3 to 4 weeks. Till it, let them resprout till the leaves are about 2 inches tall, and till it again. Let the leaves resprout till they're 2 inches tall. Do that for 2 or 3 years.
Okay. Is there a commercial product, you know, rather than using black plastic that might work to, you know, do an underlayment and then mulch over it or something?
A commercial product like to smother it, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, is there something that's a little more earth-friendly than the black plastic?
Yeah, you can use are you dealing with a large area or a small area?
It's not huge. I mean, it's the front and side of a residence. So, I mean, it's not like it's a massive area.
Okay. Go to an appliance dealer and ask them if you can have their washing machine and refrigerator boxes.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and load them up. I hope you have a pickup truck or a trailer.
I do. Okay. I have 250.
There you go. Load up a bunch of those, and make sure you bring a rock to hold them down on your way home so they don't blow out the back of your truck. Okay? And put those down across the area, and then do you save your lawn clippings by any chance if you have a lawn?
I do not even bag them.
Yeah, I think it's crazy. I don't do
those bad neighbors.
Yeah, well, no, I don't. I think it's crazy too. You should leave them on the ground to rot.
Yeah.
But you're going to want to put something down to hold those in, hold that cardboard in place. The cardboard is going to start to deteriorate after a year or so, and you're going to need to keep it there for a couple of years. Your other choice is just to go get some more cardboard the next year and keep that on there.
Okay. Great. Well, yeah, thank you so much for your help. I'll definitely give that a try.
Good luck.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. We have an email from Joe in Portage County. Has a low-growing grass that forms beautiful patches in some parts of his sandy field. It gets no higher than 6 inches. I'm guessing it's fescue. I would love to get this to take over my lawn. If I took plugs out of the field, will it spread?
Well, the first question you want to answer here is it really fescue? There is another possibility in your part of the state that this could be a sedge, members of the genus Carex, C-A-R-E-X. And there are a couple of Carexes, or Carices, that will grow in open sun or shade in very dry, sandy soil. Some of these are rhizomatous, and they will creep by runners slowly to form a sod. So you indeed may have that, and that would be a good option for you to go and transplant those about 9 to 12 inches apart, and in about 3 years it will probably fill in. You have to control the weeds between them in the interim. If it's a fescue grass, it may be one of the naturalized fescues, identical or similar to the fescues in our Nomo lawn mix. These typically are clump formers, and they will not spread by rhizomes, generally speaking, unless you have a creeping red fescue that got established there, which is possible if it was from a previous planting that somebody else did. But if it's a natural area, probably not. So, but in the long term, you may actually find it's a lot less work to prepare your lawn area and just plant the Nomo lawn from seed, because compared to going out and pulling up all those transplants and putting them in, man, that is a ton of work. So look at what what your time is worth. It may be simpler and cheaper and easier for you just to plant a Nomo lawn.
Let's go to David in Hayward. David, hello.
Hey, Larry. Hey, I haven't established my lawn yet, but I have it all graded out, and I get a lot of clover growing down there. And I don't really want to have a grass lawn. I want something that I could cut every 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And I was wondering if your guests had any ideas of mixing clover with another plant to do a good ground cover or lawn type thing.
Well, you know, before the turf care companies all talked us into having lawns like golf courses, it was not uncommon for lawn grass mixes in America until the 60s to have about 5% white Dutch clover in them. And why was that? Because white Dutch clover is a legume, and guess what? It adds nitrogen, so you don't have to put fertilizers on. But wait a minute, that's bad for business. So here's what we want to do. We want to sell you just grasses that you're going to have to buy our fertilizers from a vertically integrated company, okay? And you'll have to buy a lawnmower to keep it at 2 inches. Of course, you're going to probably have that anyway, but you're going to mow it all the time because it has to be 2 inches now instead of 4 inches, so you'll mow it 3 times as often. And you're going to have to buy weed killers because there's going to be broadleaf weeds that get in there, so you're going to have to go spray it. And if you sprayed your clover with a broadleaf, it would probably kill it or harm it significantly. So it's all a marketing ploy. So you can indeed use a combination of turf and Dutch white clover. Make sure it's Dutch white clover and not red clover or, God forbid, sweet clover, which is an invasive non-native plant. And that can be a very useful lawn combination. However, the white clover sometimes can be very aggressive and it may take all over your grass, but hey, it stays low. And if that's your goal, that's great. And honeybees love the white clover.
Yeah, and it will be irrigated, so I shouldn't have any problem growing it because I have a heavy clay soil there. So
okay, you know what you would do in that case? Heavy clay soil, probably a combination of bluegrass, perennial rye, and 5% white clover should do you pretty well.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
You bet. Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. And let's go to Tom in Brussels. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking the call. I want to put in a plug for the use of glyphosate or Roundup for feeding back the non-natives. I had some really ugly, nasty infestations of reed canary grass. I mean, this stuff was so thick and dense that I could lose my full-grown Labrador Retriever in it. So what I did is I hit it late in the fall with about a 6% solution, really knocked it back. I hit it early the next spring, picked the seed heads. I did this for like 3 years in a row. And you know what? Now I got the most beautiful establishment of sun drops and blue vervain and a whole bunch of other bottomland sedges. The seeds had been in the soil for years. They just needed an opportunity to be released.
It is amazing the seed bank of native species that you'll find in wetlands after you get rid of the bad guys.
Yeah. Now I got another question for you. I had an establishment of small tree seedlings that were maybe about 6 inches to a foot tall. They were maybe 3-4 years old. And I had an infestation of, I think it was a four-seeded vetch, and it was just choking these guys out. So a couple of months ago, before the vetch went to seed, I sprayed Transline over the top, and it just literally wiped it out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, shortly thereafter, I found some of this vetch growing in my lawn. So I mixed up a small batch of the Transline, put it in a backpack sprayer, sprayed the vetch that was in my lawn. Well, you know what? When I went and looked a few weeks ago, I got the most beautiful section of turf grass. There is not a weed, a vetch, or anything growing in it. And the turf is doing great. Now, I know this stuff isn't labeled for lawn use, but am I onto something?
Well, Transline is a broadleaf herbicide and a very effective one. It's just a reformulation of all these broadleaf herbicides that have been used for many, many years. So whether it's labeled for lawn or not, it's not dissimilar from what's used on most lawns. So, and again, it's heavy-duty stuff, so be careful out there with that Transline. But, yeah, it'll kill pretty much any broadleaf and will leave your grasses untouched, which is why your lawn looks so great now.
There you have it, Tom. Thank you very much for calling. Robin in Portage, we're on to you now. Hi, Robin.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, Robin.
How you doing?
Good. Yourself?
Great.
Good.
I know it's been a long time since you've been to my house, but maybe you can kind of recall. I have the deep backyard, and beyond my back fence, I had this huge oak tree, which I have now lost half of it, so I have a lot more sun.
Mm-hmm.
But I do not have full sun during all day. I would like to plant prairie plants or seed back there, but I don't know if it will be compatible.
Okay.
The sun right now is hitting the east corner and the north corner. It does have woods on two sides of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's open on the other two sides. So periodically throughout the day, I do get all four corners of that area with sun, but it's not full sun all day.
Okay. And this is between the house and the big tree?
Or
on the other
no,
side?
No, it's going to be beyond the
okay.
big tree.
Back of the tree. Okay.
Yep.
Got it. Okay.
Between the tree and the woods.
Okay. Because you have sandy soil,
yep,
the requirement for sun will be a little bit less than for a heavier clay soil or loamy soil.
Okay.
And a general rule of thumb is that if you get a half a day of direct sun, you can grow almost any prairie plant or grass or flower in that situation.
Oh, fantastic.
And because of your dry, sandy soil, the soil is going to warm up more than, say, a clay, which gives you an added advantage in that half a day of full sun area.
Okay, so, well, my thought was to round up what's there now, use Roundup on it because it's crabgrass and creeping Charlie and a bunch of junk.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone was actually going to put in black dirt because I've got this big ruts, but I don't want the black dirt then, do I?
You don't need the black dirt.
No.
And here's the beauty of selecting the right prairie mix is you can save a ton of money because the default position for gardening is bring in more black dirt. Okay, especially if you have like a dry, sandy soil. But there are so many wonderful, beautiful native prairie plants that will grow in the poor kind of sandy soil that you have in your backyard that you don't need to add any dirt. You don't have to spend all that money. Just select one of the dry prairie mixes for sandy soils at the appropriate height. You know, we have mixes for low growing, for short, for medium, for tall. Select the mix that you want to match your soil, and you do not have to bring in any soil amendments whatsoever. Save a lot of money and time.
Well, we'll have to talk about that.
You know where to find me.
All right. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks for calling. James in the town of Chase. On to you now. Hi.
Yeah. Good afternoon. This is James Hayward. Hello, Neil.
Hello, Mr. Hayward. How are you today?
Very well.
Good.
I'm calling you from the historic Chase Stone Barn.
Excellent.
Yep. And my question to you is, when you do establish these prairie plantings, do certain species become dominant? And so I'll start to say goodbye to you and listen to your answer.
That is an outstanding question. And if you look at a prairie that is established from seed, it goes through a process of ecological succession. And because the vast majority of the species in a prairie are perennials, they take a number of years to mature. And that is why we make sure to include the biennial black-eyed Susan, because a lot of people don't want to wait 3 to 5 years to have flowers. So thank God for black-eyed Susan. Because the first year, it pretty much is going to look like weeds because the native prairie plants are growing slowly. They're building root systems for the future, and your annual weeds tend to dominate. The second year, lo and behold, black-eyed Susan show up. All is good. And then starting in the third year, you typically start to see the maturation of some of the earlier maturing perennial grasses and flowers. And many of those flowers will be dominant in the third, fourth, fifth year, but they will start to fade as the really long-term, long-lived prairie plants start to take over. And some of these prairie plants live for decades. And you will see that your whole prairie seeding goes through various like life cycles as it matures and changes. And then what plants might be dominant? That is very interesting because it may depend upon the soils, the pH, the calcium, the magnesium, who knows? There's factors that we don't necessarily know, and I can take the same prairie mix and plant it in 5 different places, and those prairies will be all different because of the growing conditions, and the plants will kind of sort themselves out. Like at my house, I put down the same seed mix across about an acre of an area, and it's just this rocky, junky soil, and I cannot believe at the variation in how those plantings turned out based upon various conditions that I could not predict. Maybe this area was sandier, and that area was loamier, that area was rockier, who knows? And they just kind of find their own way. So what plants become dominant can vary from site to site, and also based upon the age of the prairie.
And in the last 30 seconds, the Department of Natural Resources has just released a field guide to terrestrial invasive plants in Wisconsin. Neil brought a copy in, and it's some great colored pictures and some great descriptions. And you can get a copy if you go to the DNR website, and then, Neil, just go to the invasive plants.
I think the Bureau of Endangered Resources.
And Bureau of Endangered Resources.
They put this out. They've done a wonderful job helping people to identify problem plants, non-native plants that have that are threatening our native ecosystems, and also provide you with some information on how to control them. So it's a wonderful new publication, just came out. And
with that, we conclude. Neil, thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Neil Debo, president of Prairie Nursery, the website prairienursery.com. Thank you for listening. Stay with us.